So I want to welcome all of you here. I'm glad you're able to hook in with the link. Okay, so tonight, as we mentioned, we're going to talk about the theme, If You Want Peace, Work for Justice. And we're all familiar with that slogan. You've seen it in protests and rallies, et cetera. But we thought we'd like to take a kind of a Christian perspective of it as we look out at the world, and there's so much violence and division and unjust situations. So we're glad to have Michael Nocello as our speaker today. I also want to mention that we have a program in our province called POPS, P-O-P-S, Proclaiming Our Passion, a Story, which is people who come online together like we are now, and they share their own personal stories, or stories of something in their life or their family related to the passionist charism. So we welcome anybody from the POPS group. And then Michael is from Canada, up in Peterborough, Ontario. He worked at our parish in Toronto for a while, and then he's also been director of education for Catholic Schools Board in Ontario. So he has a rich background, especially in the social teachings of the Catholic Church. And so we thought he would be a great speaker. So I'm going to kind of help focus our attention with a prayer. You know, just we might have been madly running to get here at 6:30 or 7:30 or 4:30, whatever. So maybe a prayer can kind of help settle us down, focus our mind, our spirit, and then I'll turn it over to Michael. So let us pray. Grant us, Lord God, a vision of your world as your love would have it. A world where the weak are protected and no one goes hungry or poor. A world where the riches of creation are shared and everyone can enjoy them. A world where different races and cultures live in harmony and mutual respect. A world where peace is built with justice and justice is guided by love. Give us the inspiration and courage to build it through Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
Michael, I'll turn it over to you and let you maybe more fully introduce yourself.
Great. Thanks so much, Don. And hello, everybody. It's great to see you all. My heart is warmed by seeing so many of our Canadian compatriots here joining us tonight. I think there was a message probably went out through the St. Gabriel's Parish Bulletin in Toronto. But at any rate, it's good to see you all. And I'm very appreciative and honored by the invitation from the POPS Committee and from the OME, in particular, the Office of Mission Effectiveness, to lead our learning session tonight. I have to say, if you've ever heard the term those social justice types, I've hardly ever considered myself such a person. I could probably count on one hand the number of protests I've attended in my life. But the one thing I do know is that as my life and my work has gone on, more and more I've been confronted by issues that required a response of justice. And whether that was in my own family or in my work in Catholic education in Ontario, I have found that challenge come right before me over and over again. And so I think that I have come to some learning about this topic just through my own personal experience and my work experience and life as it's led me along. And now I find myself as the director of the Passionist Solidarity Network, which is the office of justice, peace, and the integrity of creation for the Passionists in North America. And I'm very privileged to be part of that team and the board that leads that initiative in the province, in concert with other such offices around the world. So it's been an exciting year and a half since I began this work. And I hope tonight I'll lead us through some learning and some reflection and maybe a few reminders for many of you of what Catholic social teaching and justice and peace are all about. I'm going to share my screen with you here. And we can go through, have some visuals to look at while we're talking. And okay, so there we go. Just a little slow responding. So just a little bit about me, my family, and father, husband and father of three, grandfather of four, and as you heard him in Peterborough, my academic background is in religious education and executive leadership. I'm a former Catholic teacher, and I always try to refer myself as a Catholic teacher first and foremost, but I've also been a school and a system administrator. I consider myself an alumnus of the Passionists. I studied and learned with them for a number of years in my younger years. And as you heard, a former pastoral associate and liturgical musician at St. Gabriel's. I do a bit of consulting work now with Catholic school boards, in addition to my work with the Passionist Solidarity Network. I co-chair the retirees of the Catholic Superintendents Association in Ontario. I'm on the board of our local college here in Peterborough. And sometime in there, I enjoy retirement, which is a lot of fun too. See if I can get this to respond a little quicker here. There we go. So tonight, I hope that through an overview of the principles of Catholic social teaching, sometimes referred to as a call to justice, we will explore peace within and among and around us, which only comes about, I think, when we allow ourselves to be moved deeply. And I'm borrowing a phrase from our Canadian Passionist Father, Steve Dunn, who often uses the phrase to become painfully aware of something. And when we allow that to happen, we allow ourselves to be moved deeply, and then we can change our thinking at a deep level, and we can possibly engage in some new or different action, whether that's alone or together. I posed three questions that you're going to hear a number of times tonight. And they were, I think, sent out as you accepted the invitation to join. But I'll pose them again. And I'd like you to try and keep these before us, before yourselves. What would be one, either global or local, issue of injustice that is concerning you at this time? You may have already thought of one. You might think of one now. Jot it down. One global or local issue of injustice that concerns you at this time. And what is it about this issue that appears most unjust? As we go through the themes and principles of Catholic social teaching tonight, I'd like you to pick one or two at the most that most speak to you about that issue that you've selected. And how might it offer you a lens for you to analyze the issue more deeply and frame a gospel response? We're going to talk about that in small groups later on. And then when we come back from those small groups, we're going to reflect together on what new thinking or action does that awareness call you to, and how can that contribute, even in a small way, to a greater peace. I don't think peace is something we just finally arrive at. Peace is a process. And we engage in peace to the extent that we engage in justice. I think that's the bottom line of my message tonight, and the message of the church to us. And so I'm going to invite us to reflect on what that means and what that looks like as we walk through a little bit of the history of this rich, rich part of our Catholic faith. A little bit of context about Catholic social teaching. So we know the stories and the scriptures, but a few of them came to mind. The terrible story of Cain and Abel and the injustice that grew out of jealousy and led to murder. So a terrible injustice that was done, and that is a one of the mythical stories of sin in our Hebrew scriptures. The powerful story of Nathan confronting King David after David has sent Uriah, the husband of Bathsheba, out to the front lines to be killed, not out of any military prowess, but solely so he can then do the noble thing and claim his wife Bathsheba as his own. And Nathan confronts him with his treachery, and David has to acknowledge it and repent. The beautiful story of Jesus and the woman who was accused by the crowd gathering her around her, and his powerful words to them: if there's one among you who's not sinned, let them cast the first stone. And of course, one by one, as we know the story, they disappear. Jesus at the temple driving out the sellers, perhaps not so much because they were selling, but because of the kind of unjust practices they were more than likely engaging in their selling. And then that beautiful passage, powerful passage of St. Paul in Corinthians, where he talks about and challenges the community for their lack of care towards the widow and the orphan. They're bickering and fighting with each other, and yet they come together to celebrate the Eucharist. They don't even share the food they've brought. And he says to them, your behavior is a condemnation. The Eucharist you celebrate is a condemnation on yourself because of the lack of integrity that you bring. So we have a great richness of tradition. These are just a few examples in our scriptures that call to mind the essence of our faith, which is about how we live the call to love. In our church's history, we've seen so many examples, but I'll just touch on a few. The rise of the monasteries in the Middle Ages and religious orders, where feeding the poor and caring for the sick became very important focus points in small communities and in cities, of course, alike. And then the prophetic role of religious orders in the history of the church. The Passionists, of course, and the St. Paul of the Cross preaching hope to despair, and the call of followers to do the same. Catherine of Siena, who took on a pope to challenge him to do the right thing and to engage in just practices. And the Jesuits in North America, who in their zealous missionary work were confronted with the common elements of indigenous religion that they wrote back even to their own superiors in France to say, we see so many pieces of common ground between the faith that we encounter in these good people and the faith that we've come to teach them. So very early and powerful witnesses. But I think in the 19th and 20th century, there's been an explosion of articulation of Catholic social teaching. Why? Well, because there's been an explosion of awareness. So we know so much more. We see so much more. We are able to tell each other and write about. And today we can see things evolving live. The global and planetary awareness that we have, quintessentially for me, certainly captured in that beautiful Apollo 8 photograph of the Earth from the moon, where we can finally realize that we're part of a planetary community, a living and breathing organism. And that new consciousness that Father Thomas Berry articulated when he said, the human is that being when the universe brought forth when it became conscious of itself. We are the consciousness of the universe. So that's the context, I think, for our awareness of these statements around how we should live our faith in the world today. And probably the one phrase of all of the teachings, I'm going to walk through them really quickly in a moment, but St. Paul VI, who said development is the new name for peace, way back in 1967. And that in a way has crystallized the focus on practices of justice as the essential ingredient for leading us to peace. So there's been lots of things written by the church, by popes on this topic. Right back to 1891 is probably one of the earliest ones in at least in our recent memory, but no doubt were some before, where Leo XIII talked about the rights of workers. And Pius XI, again, reiterating that not only the concern for workers, but introducing the idea, which is one of the principles of Catholic social teachings, of subsidiarity. Interesting word. We're going to break it open in a few minutes. John XXIII, in 1962, first introduced that very familiar process to us of observe, judge, and act. Any of us who've worked in religious education, especially with the young, know that see, judge, act process that we engage in. And John articulated that for the first time back in 1962. He also talked about the global interdependence that we need to strive for. In 63, he talked about, in Peace on Earth, basic human rights and the respect for rights and the common good. Powerful phrase that starts to emerge in our Catholic teaching, the common good. The Second Vatican Council, of course, brought forth that incredible document, The Church in the Modern World, where we're challenged to see our engagement in the world based on signs of the times. And you've heard so often that phrase to preach with the Bible in one hand and the newspaper in the other, that we use the lens of what is happening right in front of us to interpret the gospel. Paul VI mentioned him already, the unjust economic structures that he challenges in 1967, and goes on further to outline the Christian duty to participate in 1971 in his encyclical call to action, not to observe and watch from the sidelines, but to engage and participate. And begins to articulate that phrase that we know so well, the preferential option for the poor. John Paul II was a prolific writer in the church's history, and many pieces that he's left us with in 1979, where he talks about questioning materialism and begins to articulate the degradation of the environment as a moral issue for our time, and connects violations of human rights with war. In 1981, his beautiful work on human work, where he outlines for us work as a fundamental dimension of our human existence and is important to our human fulfillment, but also that work has to have dignity, that workers have to stand as more important than profit, that workers have the right to unionize, and they have to be able to be in solidarity with each other. Further, in 87, he writes about the dignity of all creation, and he introduces the idea of sinful social structures. Interesting articulation that I know we're familiar with, but to know, to see the progression of these ideas throughout the last 100 or so years. Reiterates in a couple of years later, the rights of workers in 1995, affirms life as a gift, addresses the threats to life, talks about life as a responsibility, and introduces the phrase of integral human development. Benedict goes on to talk about love, God's call to love our neighbor as stemming from God's love for humanity. And then, of course, Francis very, very powerfully focuses us on the ecological crisis in Laudato Si and later in Laudate Deum, demanding an interior conversion, a new way of seeing our interconnectedness, and challenges us to reduce consumption. That points out that the poor are suffering even more than anyone else because of ecological degradation, and talks about God's vision for a renewed relationship. And then finally, in just a couple of years ago in Fratelli Tutti, he talks about the isolation and crisis that humanity is facing, the need for true social engagement and friendship, the call to welcome the stranger, and again, that integral development that is so key to humanity's evolution. So I'm not going to tell you all about the compendium of Catholic social teaching, but just a little point in the introduction that caught my eye when I was scanning this document. So it's not a long document. It's maybe a couple of hundred pages, but in the intro, the cardinal who leads the office thanks his predecessor. And his predecessor, and this I think is important to the context of Catholic social teaching. His predecessor was a Vietnamese cardinal named Cardinal Nguyen Van Tran. And he talks about the seeds of those who bore witness to the cross being woven throughout the documents of Catholic social teaching. And he makes reference to the terrible and dark years in Vietnam. So he doesn't go into any other detail. And one can only guess that perhaps he's talking about the whole evolution of the war in Vietnam and the scars that has left, the political upheaval in that country, the poverty. But I think what's important to me is that he grounds Catholic social teaching in a series of events, and that it doesn't just fall out of the sky, but it comes out of our human experience. It comes out of reading the signs of the times and looking at the events of the world and saying, what is it we need to do to speak to this authentically? How can that move us deeply to make different choices? So you probably were referred to an article, a short little summary that included 10 principles of Catholic social teaching. There's actually a whole bunch of different ones to look at. Sometimes there's 8, sometimes there's 10. I've seen 12, but I'm going to go with the short version tonight and offer you 7 to consider. And so these come from the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. And if you ever get a chance to look at their website and just search Catholic social teaching, there's absolutely wonderful resources there for any program or conversation you want to lead or engage in with others. Some great, great activities there. But here's the 7 I'm going to guide us through tonight. So first, the life and dignity of the human person. Second, the call to family, community, and participation. Third, the rights and responsibilities that we all share. Fourth, the preferential option for the poor, the vulnerable, the dignity of work and the rights of workers, solidarity, and care for God's creation. In some versions of these principles, you'll see some of the other words I've already mentioned. Some of them break these out a little more detailed, but these are the 7 I'm going to use to frame our conversation tonight. So let's kind of dive into them. We'll just do a quick overview of each one and then summarize them. So first, the life and dignity of the human person. Interesting word, the inviolability of all human life. something that we cannot violate. That's how it's positioned. John Paul II talks about it in the Gospel of Life. But I became aware of another little tidbit of our Catholic teaching and learning back when I was doing some courses at St. Michael's College in Toronto. And I had a wonderful teacher, a woman by the name of Mary Malone, who wrote a book about Mary called Who Is My Mother? And in that book, and in one of the classes that she led that I was present for, she talked about Pius XII's declaration of the Assumption of Mary as a Catholic social teaching. And I was really intrigued by this, as was most of the class. And she went on to say that if you read the document, there's a very short sentence that says, the teaching of the church, the dogma is that Mary was assumed body and soul into heaven. She said, that's not what the document's about. It's in the next sentence. In the next sentence, it says, by this teaching, let us affirm the inviolable dignity of the human person, body and soul. So I was intrigued by this, and we were asking Mary, what is this about? And she said, well, when you look at the context of Pius XII in 1950, when this teaching came out, he talks about the fact that World War II had ended only 5 years earlier. He was under some scrutiny for his silence during that time on a number of issues, not the least of which was the Holocaust, and had a needed to say something, but what would he say? What could he say? And he frames his teaching, his statement about human dignity, the inviolable dignity of human person, body and spirit, within this teaching about Mary. Thought it was fascinating. So never thought about the Assumption as a Catholic social teaching, but there it is for your consideration. The life and dignity of the human person. I think most of us know of the beautiful image that Cardinal Bernardin used of the seamless garment as he described the consistent ethic of life from conception to natural death. Thankfully, an image that's resurfacing in the times we're in now and so important. But obviously the focus of every person being made in God's image and likeness, giving its inherent dignity, and not only life, but the fullness of life. And this theme's going to come up in a few times as we go through these principles, a sharing in the life of God. So that's the first one, life and dignity of the human person. Think about these as you're in the lens of your, or as lenses through which you can look at the issue that you chose at the beginning of our session tonight. The second one, a call to family, community, and participation. So clearly based in the foundation of our belief that it is, that we're meant to be social beings, we're not meant to be alone. That persons form families, that families form communities who form the human family. And when we talk about families, we're talking about all kinds of families, the richness of the variety of families in our world and in our church. And family is often referred to as the way to holiness. How communities organize must maintain the dignity and life of all persons. And that everyone has a right to participate in life, the economic, political, and cultural life, the religious life, the faith life. And not only do we have a right to participate, but we have an obligation to participate, to not sit on the sidelines. And this includes subsidiarity. So I mentioned that word earlier. Interesting little word, maybe not so little. But what it means is to work something out at the level where those most affected by it are engaged, are participating. And there've been a number of communities in our recent years who've coined a phrase that for me captures what this is all about. And it's that phrase, nothing about us without us. I'm sure you've heard that. Nothing about us without us. That's what subsidiarity is. So that's this principle of Catholic social teaching, that we pull things, whether it's an issue to be resolved, a conflict, we let things be worked out among those who are most affected by the implications of what will be decided. That is not a top-down structure, unless it absolutely needs to be, but that in fact most things can be worked out in community among those who are most affected. And of course, that demands goodwill, that demands a sense of harmony, a sense of trying to reach the common good, trying to agree. It means, if we use the famous words now of our beloved Pope Francis, we have to listen and listen deeply and allow ourselves to be touched and moved by what we hear. So the call to family, community, and participation. Let's move on. Rights and responsibilities. Well, the right to life and necessities of life, the right to private property, along with the responsibility to ensure the rights of others to life and to ensure that their rights are met, that they can live. It's kind of a social contract, isn't it? More recently, we've heard about the right to migrate safely. What a huge process that we're witnessing and getting closer to, all of us in some way. The movement of people to find safety and security and health. The right to regulate borders, along with the responsibility to do so in a just manner. And on, the engagement of rights and responsibilities together. So that's a principle of our Catholic faith, that those two work hand in hand. Is that a helpful lens for you to look at that issue that you named earlier? The preferential option for the poor and the vulnerable, the least of these brothers and sisters of mine. Right to the heart of the gospel, isn't it? There's a little piece of canon law that I don't know about you. In my work, I've had a few people in my time quote canon law to me, and it's never been this passage. But this one I find quite fascinating. The Christian faithful are obliged to promote social justice and to assist the poor from their own resources. Wow. I haven't heard that very often, but how powerful a statement is that? Obliged to promote social justice and to assist the poor from our own resources. So how do we treat the most vulnerable among us? How do we deal with those who are begging on our streets as we walk down that street? I find it a constant challenge, but not one that we can look away from. And as I've heard said a number of times, not only our charity, but our economics have to be challenged. So we go back to John Paul's statement about the social structures. It's not just about giving from what I have extra in my pocket, when I can, when I feel like it, when I remember, but it's about us engaging in that conversation at a deep level about the economics that keep things the way they are, to challenge the ways in which we keep the poor in their poverty. And that deeper look, that if we do that, in fact, we're keeping ourselves in a different kind of poverty. And it's not an economic poverty, but it's a poverty of spirit. It's a poverty of love. And so to the extent that we're willing and ready and able to move towards the call of the gospel to the least of these brothers and sisters of ours, we're willing to take on some of these tough questions. and they aren't easy. They challenge our politics, our family structures, our church structure, the things we're comfortable with, right? Let's keep going. The dignity and the rights of workers. Over and over, we've heard from the statements I quoted earlier, economy must serve people. It's not a system. To read a newspaper, one might think it's a system that exists in and of itself for itself. Yet its role is to serve the human community. Work is at the heart of human activity. Workers have the right to productive work, to decent, fair wages, safe working conditions, to unionize. Remember, the unions began in a time when workers were being abused, and they were efforts of, in some cases, the church, in some cases, others who saw clearly the injustices. They were efforts to bring people together to protect the safety of workers. Workers also have a responsibility to fully and faithfully perform the work they have agreed to. Remember that earlier principle of rights and responsibilities working together. And I love this phrase from John Paul, that our work allows us to become architects of a new humanity. So powerful. That's something I've tried to keep in front of me throughout my life of work, that we are becoming architects of a new humanity. So our work accomplishes something, regardless of what it is. And we need to see it not just as drudgery, not just as the day-to-day, the ordinary, but as something that we can transcend all of those things and take us to a place where we see that through our work, we're making a difference. We're changing the world, we're changing the lives of people around us. And we need to pay close attention to how it's doing that. Solidarity. So this is about our humanity, belonging to one family, loving our neighbor as ourselves, engaging in compassion, in suffering with. That new vision of unity, of humanity, the reflection of the unity of God. And again, not only our charity being challenged, but transforming the structures around us. We stand together. I have to admit, one of the things that I've been challenged with in my role working with the Passion of Solidarity Network is the writing of letters on political and difficult issues that are taking place. And it kind of happens on two fronts. One of them is I receive requests for the passionists to sign on to letters that already exist. That's kind of easy because you can filter them out and say, okay, this makes sense. This is true to who we are. This is not so much. That's not so difficult. It's the composing of letters. It's the deciding, you know, this is an issue on which we have to speak out. And how do we speak? What words do we use? Like, that's challenging. And I find it pushes me to look deeply at where my faith has come from, where we as a community are going, how we speak in a way that continues to include and not exclude, to speak compassion without speaking words that are going to block the message of the gospel of love to others. So I find that probably one of the more challenging pieces of what I'm doing at this time. We'll have a few minutes shortly to share some of our own experiences of that, I hope. And finally, stewardship of creation as a principle of Catholic social teaching. The goods of earth are a gift from God. We're called to be respectful of all of God's creation, to protect people and planet, this incredible phenomenon of migration that we're witnessing in the world today. One of the primary causes of that is ecological degradation, that the state of the earth where so many people are is not sustaining them, and they have to flee. Climate crisis, other forms of ecological destruction. And of course, we know from our from indigenous leaders, indigenous wisdom speakers, what we do to the earth, we do to ourselves. And within the context of our own faith, we do to God. And this transformation, says Thomas Berry, requires spiritual energy. It takes the energy that comes out of our spirit, out of our faith, out of our hearts, to work at the changes that we need to engage in. So, seven principles of Catholic social teaching. Here they are again. The life and dignity of the human person, the call to family, community, and participation, our rights integrated with our responsibilities, the preferential option for the poor and the vulnerable, the dignity of our work and the rights of workers, solidarity, the challenge to solidarity, to stand with those who are struggling, and to be engaged in caring for God's creation. So these are, I would suggest, are the elements of justice. And if we do these, we move ourselves, our communities, and our world towards peace. Not a peace that is once and for all, but a peace that is a process, a peace that we have to constantly engage in. And I would suggest to you that by living into these Catholic social teachings and their call to justice, we are working at peace within, among, and around us. And it comes about when, as I said at the beginning, we allow ourselves to be moved deeply, to become aware, which is why I asked you to think about an issue that means something to you at this time. It comes about when we change our thinking integrally. And integrally, I mean in its connected parts. So not just what I think about this or that, but holistically, how we change our approach to the world, how we view the world. And then finally, that energizes us, moves us, compels us to engage in some new or different action, either by myself or us together. A new energy is born when we engage in this process. So I offer you that for your reflection and to chew on a little bit. And hopefully now we will take a short break and then engage in some conversation about the global issue that you chose, or the local issue, and what it is that is unjust in that issue for you. And which one, two at the most, but try to stick with one of the themes or principles of Catholic social teaching most speaks to you about that issue? How might it offer you a lens to take a look at that issue more deeply and to frame a response inspired by the gospel? And then we'll talk about what new possibilities there are for us in how we act as we come back together. Talib, I'm going to turn it back to you.
Thank you, Michael. So we will take a short break here, about 5 minutes. You can refresh yourself, whatever you need to do, and then when we come back, we will go into small groups. This is now our question and answer part. So what we'll do is, please go ahead and keep yourself on mute unless you are actually asking a question of Michael. And if you want to use the raise hand function on the bar at the lower half or bottom of your screen, might be at the top depending on how your settings are, there is should be a symbol that says raise hand. And note that's different from the reaction raise hand, which is just you waving at us. And then I'll go ahead and call on you so we can have a discussion. So whenever you're ready, just go ahead and click that raise hand button and we'll invite you to unmute.
But even if you wave, we'll call on you.
If I see it, that's the thing. I get a little bell if you raise your hand with the raise your hand function.
Or if you'd like to share something that came out of that group discussion too, without repeating the whole group discussion, but just a highlight or maybe a little bit of a conclusion that propels you forward to some new idea or a new action. So either or.
Go ahead, Robin.
Michael, I just was wondering how, thinking about the situation in Israel and Gaza, how do you connect some of these principles with that?
Yeah, thank you.
Such a painful issue. And I didn't mean to give you such a hard question. I know it's a hard question. But...
No, you know, I thank you for it, because I've been grappling with it the last number of weeks and even today, because one of our board members in the PSN shared a absolutely powerful letter written by a group of religious communities of women, signed by them and a number of Northwestern U.S. bishops. And it was, it's probably one of the more beautiful, it's not the right word, but moving, I guess, letters and statements about that situation as a witness to what our faith calls us to in speaking to this horrendous situation of injustice. Absolutely. So, and that's one of the pieces when I mentioned earlier, the kind of dual nature of the advocacy part of our work, the letter writing has been, this one has been really tough. I've been chewing on this one and, you know, how do you word it in such a way that it doesn't become inflammatory or isn't, you know, it just does hits the right notes, I guess, that I want to, and maybe that's, it doesn't need that much thinking. Maybe it we should just speak to it, you know, out of our faith. But certainly the piece around solidarity for me is so important. Like, and how do you stand with people that won't know you're standing with them? Like, well, won't hear our voice, but we still have to exercise our voice. So those are some of the pieces I'm grappling with, at least anyway. I don't know if that's an answer, but it's part of the struggle I think all of us maybe are in when we are faced with such a gargantuan issue. You know, maybe the place we can speak is to our own politicians who are exercising their voices in support or not in support or whichever way they're speaking, to let them know what we think about this and what we want to say to them out of our faith. Because it's the bottom line is innocent people are dying, and it shouldn't be, and it doesn't have to be, it, at least from my maybe uneducated stance. But, you know, more killing isn't going to solve this, right?
Thank you.
Jack.
Yeah, hi. You brought this up, and the line about justice with love really floored me, because that's exactly what I've been looking for in my own thinking about Israel and Gaza. Remember when the war started, they were always talking about what's the end game to the war. And in my own mind, I can't imagine that if the end game is not peace and justice, then it's probably not a valid war. It's not a good war. It's not a defensible kind of war. And where I got bogged down was in justice. Well, justice, could be a lot of revenge in there. There could be a lot of bitterness and certainly no love in it, in the desire to get justice for a wrong that has been done. But you add that little phrase with love to justice, and you put that together with wanting peace for both or all peoples at the end. How would that make the end game look?
Yeah, you know, Jack, there's so many layers of injustice of history, of the weight of the pain of the past that both peoples are carrying, and you know how to help them, how to pray for them, how to inspire a conversation, even locally where we are, that is new, that tries to say maybe there's a new way to approach this that is loving, you know, and that changes the conversation a little bit. And yet people seem to jump back to injustice. I mean, we have a Mount Sinai Hospital in Toronto, and it has been the site of anti-Israel protests in the last couple of days. So that's stirred up all kinds of emotions, and that's just in one city and on one street, in one place, and God knows it's happening in so many other places. But we are involved in conversations, and I think if we can push ourselves to bring some of this call to justice to our conversation, that can only help us. And frankly, I don't think most of us are used to talking this way. This is right. This is like, I don't even know what words to use. Like I'm trying to learn a little bit of Spanish, and I struggle to find the words I want to. I know what I want to say in my language, but to translate it, it takes time. So it's the same thing. We're trying to speak about a new reality in a way we're not used to speaking, and yet we got to go through. We need to push ourselves, I believe. Margaret.
I think about this issue, I tend to get extremely angry. I yell at the radio, I yell at the TV. But then I call to myself, it comes to me, especially as Canadians, we need to speak with some humility, knowing that we have done the same thing with our indigenous people in our land. They don't belong to us. I shouldn't call them our indigenous, but the indigenous people of our land. And to speak from a stance of, you know, we made this mistake. We've been through this. It doesn't lead anywhere good.
Humility is never a bad place to start. It keeps us grounded, and I think it keeps us from becoming to falling into that temptation of the arrogance of knowing, thinking I have the answer, right? It keeps us listening, which is what we need to do. Jim.
I heard a very interesting discussion on NPR, National Public Radio. I was driving somewhere and I didn't get all of it, but people were talking, the person interviewed was talking about the strong stances that people take, and a lot of that is political, but almost everybody has a strong stance about something because of these issues of peace and justice. And he said one of the ways that he found helpful to look at it is to recognize that one of the reasons people take such a strong stance is because they feel some people are being wounded and some people are victims. And depending on who you choose as the wounded one, you're going to take a strong stance about that. And so, you know, take, for example, the abortion issue. You know, some people will say it's the wounded ones are the babies that are aborted. And others would say the wounded ones are the women, the mothers who don't seem to have access to proper care. And so you've got two competing issues, but everybody is wounded, and the people taking their stance choose a side who they want to defend. And I think as I think about that, it's an entrance for us as passionists to look at people who are suffering, because it really does draw our attention to the sufferings of the world. Mm-hmm. And we need to be attentive to people who are suffering. And so, I mean, I think it calls us, I think, to be just extra observant and extra compassionate towards people, and not to cut off some people because we chose other victims for ourselves. Right. To me, it gives me another way to reflect on some of these issues. And sometimes it leads to sort of paralysis. You got too many things to think about, but at least it opens up some a new possibility for me to reflect on some very difficult issues.
Thanks, Jim. Yeah, that's a really helpful distinction. And sometimes when we are in the place of responding, of ministering to, of standing with, there are voices around us that want to put us into one or another camp. And such an important thing to remember to that, that our, it's a phrase I heard a while ago, that the call is to have a broader vision and a bigger heart, and just to keep opening it to embrace more and more.
I just wanted to jump in here because something I just heard today, going off of what Jim said, wounded people wound people.
Mm. Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's that's bullying 101, right? Yep. It's yeah. So I take it back to my work in schools. I mean, just so many aggressors have been victims, and they're acting it out. It's so true. Yeah. I saw Rob. Paul's hand there.
Yeah.
I just wanted to respond to what Jim Stromer said, but first of all, Michael, thank you very much for your presentation. I found it really helpful and encouraging. When I get in my more depressive moods, when you mentioned Paul VI's 1967 encyclical on the development of peoples, there's a line in there, it's the shortest line in the encyclical, where he says the world is sick. And I don't think that has changed. And in our discussion group tonight, we talked about, you know, the environmental crisis and the loss of respect for the dignity of persons and gun violence, particularly in the United States. And there's so many ways, when you think of it, it's overwhelming that the world does seem sick. And you feel like, what in the world can we do? But I appreciated it, Jim, what you said, because I think this is a quite relevant to any member of the Passionist family who identifies with the Passionist charism, because it's all an example of how the Passion of Christ continues in our world today. And if we look at it from that perspective, I think it, instead of being overwhelmed by us, it can give us a kind of encouraging way to respond. So is there something in the Passionist charism that can give us a path forward in responding to all the challenges that beset us?
Thanks, Paul. Yeah.
Okay, does anybody else have a question for Michael?
So if there's no other questions, I have one more slide. It's really short, and it's some quotes from a Passionist who I want to share with you, and you'll recognize, many of you will recognize who it is. And let me just pull it back up. So I came across this short little piece by Father Sebastian MacDonald. Father Sebastian was a Passionist of the Holy Cross Province, the Western U.S., and he passed away just a few years ago. Very well known. So some of you lived with him. I'm sure some of you had him as your teacher, and or in other roles ministered together. But he said this in this little piece he wrote called Catholic Social Teaching at the Cross. First of all, he said, it's important that we recognize that the church does have something to say about what's happening in the world, and that's important. And I would include in that, not just the popes, but us, because I think we've had some profound things to say about what's happening in the world and the impact it has on us. And I thank you for that. He said, it's important to recognize that the popes have moved from speaking not only to bishops in the things they write, and not only to Catholics, but to everybody, the whole world. So that's an interesting place that we, that our leaders, and hopefully in us as well, in the way we exercise leadership in our faith, are attentive to everyone and try to speak to everyone. He focused on the idea of the common good. And I know that came up in a number of our small group discussions, and coins it as the kingdom of God on earth. He talked about Catholic social teaching forming a body of doctrine that outweighs any other collection of Catholic teaching on anything. He said it's powerful when you take it in its entirety. And the Catholic social teaching is deeply passionist teaching. The real sufferings of people today evoke memories in his followers, not only of Christ's own sufferings on the cross, but of people all through the ages and people today who have experienced similar suffering, the crucified of the world, the Memoria Passionis. And so we experience our crucified God through encounters with crucified people and the crucified earth. And I thought that might be a good way to summarize our conversation tonight and to wrap it up, to put it back in our passionist context, as a number of you have done in your own comments, and that we pray for our world with each other, that the passion of Christ always will be in our hearts. So, Don, I'll hand it back to you.
Okay. All right. Oh, let me turn my video on. So thank you, Michael, for sharing that reflection of Sebastian. That one statement that social teachings of the church are the greatest, most important collection of teachings. I appreciate, and I'm very happy you approached this presentation today from the angle of social teachings. I think in America, we just are not as conscious of that yet. We tend to probably get too moralistic and preach on morals. Whereas in South America or Africa, they're into these teachings of the church. So I think you helped us appreciate the importance of the social teachings, and we thank you for that, Michael. So again, thank you all for being here tonight. Thank you, Michael, for a great presentation, the way you organized it and pictured it in the PowerPoint. I think it was very helpful.